Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1972 Luis Buñuel film, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, we've watched a Buñuel film before. This is our second. I'm curious, what is your history with this film in particular? I went back and listened to our Exterminating Angel episode, which is actually very helpful and enlightening for watching this. And you had mentioned that in 1962, you were too young to have encountered that movie when it came out. Where were you at in 72, or where did you encounter this film?
Yeah, I remember being aware of it in 72, and it's one of those films where I'm pretty sure I saw it, but I have to admit that not a lot of, I mean, there were a couple of, one of the dinner scenes was kind of in my mind, so I'm pretty sure I did see it. I wouldn't have seen it when it came out, but I would have seen it long enough ago that I can't tell you when I last saw it, but probably would have been the late 70s, early 80s.
So was this the first rewatch since then?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
So what is it that stuck out with you, you know, before revisiting this? What was in your head as you were about to watch
this?
Well,
this is going to sound strange, but it was the interior scenes for some reason. It was just, you know, because there's so many scenes, obviously, that I'm sitting down at the dinner table. But maybe actually now I think about it, maybe it's the martini scene, that particular interior shot that stuck in my head. But I didn't remember any of the real action of the film. It's just, like I said, it just had that feeling of interiority that I remembered.
Well, and that actually seems pretty fitting thinking about this movie. Like, this is not a movie where plot is going to matter. I mean, there's a lot going on, but a lot of it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the point. So did anything surprise you, you know, as you rewatched this, you know, was there anything that you didn't remember or didn't expect?
Well, I think what surprised me, and this is especially maybe because I'm coming to this film from The Exterminating Angel most recently, it wasn't as coruscating as I normally think of Buñuel's criticism. You know, so it's, you know, the bourgeoisie is one of Buñuel's common targets. Priests, the church, clergy, those were his common targets. If you can even call it a satire or a critique, it's much gentler and less pointed than he was earlier in his career. And that surprised me a lot. I did not remember the tone of the film at all, but it was much more almost playful than I expected. So that surprised me. It was a lot more fun than The Exterminating Angel.
That's definitely true. I will say this is a movie that I have been aware of for a long time, much longer than I've been aware of who Luis Buñuel is. Mm. And it's mostly because of the title. I mean, this is one of those great movie titles that just sort of sticks with you. And what I like about it is the title, even if you didn't know anything about it, you hear the title and you're like, well, clearly that's a sarcastic title, mm-hmm. Right? It drips with that. You know, it almost seems like it's its own movie pitch. You hear that and you're like, I don't know what this movie is, what's going to happen in this movie, but I'm pretty sure I know what this movie's about, which is interesting. You know, if you're thinking about Buñuel as a surrealist, you know, you mentioned in our previous episode, Un Chien Angelou, his that first short that he makes with Dolly, how, I mean, that's the Andalusian dog, how the title is meaningless in what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And this is the opposite. It's like, oh, no, that's what this movie's about. Like the title actually tells you what that's going to be about.
Exactly.
In some ways, I think it also, not only what it's going to be about, but also kind of the tone of the movie in the same way. I mean, the title I would compare it most to is the long title of Dr. Strangelove,
uh-huh.
Where it's like, it would be hard to listen to that whole title to Strangelove and be like, oh, I'm surprised this is a comedy about sort of the Cold War and the bomb. It's like the title's screaming that at you. Like, this tells you it's going to be a critique, and it's going to be kind of a sarcastic semi-comedic critique, which makes it interesting then the things in this movie that aren't that are actually the things that are in some ways the most interesting, because you kind of know, like, the critique part, you kind of know he sort of gives up that right in the title, and maybe that's part of the point.
I also think too that, Sam, when the title is paired with the director, I mean, I agree that that title standing on its own is not likely to indicate that this is a documentary which is commending the bourgeoisie, for
right.
Sure. But when you see that Buñuel directed it, you know that you're in for something that is not going to be kind to the bourgeoisie.
I will say the other thing about the title is, and this is not always true, is the whole time I watched the movie, the title was running through my head. And maybe that's because it is such an interesting title, but I kept almost like subconsciously repeating that title as I was encountering, you know, the episodes or events in this movie. And I don't know why that, again, maybe it's just because of the nature of what the title is, you know, other films that doesn't happen with. And then I'll hit, like, for example, a movie we watched a few weeks ago, The Virgin Spring. I sort of forgot about that title. And then I got to the end and was like, oh, Virgin Spring, I get it. You know, like it came up at the very end. I wasn't thinking about that title throughout. This one, it runs through my head as a, I don't know, it there's something sticky about it.
I think the reason is, Sam, is because it's not just a title, it's a description.
Right.
And you are literally watching the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie throughout the film. And of course, it's also, I think it's a great title for other reasons, because it cuts both ways. Because yes, it's a critique, so discreet charm is obviously sarcastic, and yet the film seems to bear out the fact that yes, the bourgeoisie, they seem to be able to get away with just about anything. It seems like, you know, even though in their dreams they face disaster, in quote real life, they actually seem to continually emerge unscathed. So the title works as a critique and it works as a straight description. So I think that's why it stays in your head. And how can you not watch Fernando Rey and think about the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie?
Right. Right. Okay. Speaking of performers in this movie, there are probably unsurprisingly to you or listeners of this podcast, there were two performers in this film that jumped off the screen at me, and I was so happy. So the obvious one was Delphine Seyrig.
Yes.
This is 3 years before Jean Dielman, and it's like I've never seen her in something else, so it was so great. I just was so excited to see her. But then the other performer was Stephanie Audran, and I just kept looking at her thinking, why do I know this person? Like, I was just so drawn to her visually, and I had to look it up, and 15 years later she's Babette from Babette's Feast, which is one of my favorite movies, and I realized, like, oh, that's why that face is so familiar. But it was really exciting to see the two of them, and for me it functioned in a way where you know, we could talk about the characters or lack of characters in this movie to a certain degree, but like they never, and this is part of even the surrealism experience for me, is they never stopped being those people. They never stopped being the performers that they were. So there was always this kind of distance I had between them, which in some movies would be a problem. In this, I feel like it actually was oddly effective for me. Not that Buñuel was intending that, but that actually worked well for me, that I'm thinking, oh, these are people performing these roles.
Well, there's a third one you didn't mention, Sam, and that's Michel Piccolo, who has the cameo as the Minister of the Interior from Contempt.
You're right. You are absolutely right. I didn't even catch that.
Well, that's okay, because I did not catch Stefani Audran. So there you go. So.
So. As I said, 3 years ago in April of 2021, we watched Buñuel's 1962 film, The Exterminating Angels. That was 10 years earlier. And these two films are often paired together. I think maybe even in our last episode when you were talking about this, you mentioned this. And definitely in the Exterminating Angel episode, you said, the next thing to watch, if you wanted to go into more Buñuel, you talked about this. And they're sort of inversions of each other in terms of critiques. The Exterminating Angel is a dinner party that can't seem to end. This is a dinner that can't seem to ever begin. Why do you think Buñuel is drawn to this as a setting and drawn to this inversion?
Well, first of all, I have to back up and point out one more connection between the two films, and that is Ebert in his... he did two reviews of this film when it first came out in 72, and then it was a re-release in 2000 to celebrate Buñuel's centenary. And Ebert, at the beginning of the review when the film was first released, quoted Buñuel on The Exterminating Angel. And Buñuel said of that film, the best explanation of this film is that from the standpoint of pure reason, there is no explanation. So you know, one of Buñuel's resources when he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do or what he wanted to film was he always kind of came back to his dreams. And this film contains three dreams, recurring dreams that he had throughout his life. Dream of being on stage and forgetting his lines. He dreamt of meeting his dead cousin in the street and following him into a house full of cobwebs. And he also would dream of waking up to see his dead parents staring at him. So all of those dreams appear in this film. So in a way, part of what Buñuel likes to do is he likes to find vehicles for conveying this kind of dreamlike sense of reality. And I think that is a way, you know, I said earlier, this is a gentle film, if it's even a satire. But I think Buñuel is really interested in thinking about the bourgeoisie, about society from a kind of, you might say, dreamlike perspective. I mean, he even plays with this in a way with the, I love the scene when the bishop is trying to talk about Miranda to the ambassador. And he just keeps mentioning features of other South American countries. Yes. Oh no, that's Colombia. Oh no, that's Argentina. Oh no, that's Guatemala. So it's almost like Buñuel is kind of challenging himself to how can I think about the world, whether it's a geographic or a political world, or whether it's the social world, how can I think about that world and kind of counter it with the dream world that I am so comfortable in? So I don't know why it's, so to me, that's one thing he's trying to do. He's trying to find another vehicle for his interest in dreams and reality.
That scene is also a great moment for thinking about critiques of the West. And I mean, this is particularly true of America in terms of like our lack of understanding of the rest of the world. Because there's another part later where they're trying to figure out if Miranda's in the Southern Hemisphere or the Northern Hemisphere. And if it's summer here, will it be winter there? And they're trying to, you know, to figure all that out. And it's like, that is a, it's an interesting thing. So one of the things, I can't remember which, this might've been in the Criterion review, that they were talking about how in 1972, this film was critiquing a particular class of people. And it's like, that is now the class of people in 2024 or whenever, who might be the people who would be most inclined to see this film and like this film, you know, and I will say there are lots of moments where I was troubled by how much I related to the characters that this film is critiquing, you know, and in small ways. But it's like, oh, they do this thing, and it's like, I know that this is frustrating, but it's like, but I can't help feeling I might have felt the same way if I was in that. And you know, that's maybe one of the things I was thinking a lot with this film is like the relationship between surrealism and doing a kind of straightforward critique. Like, are those compatible? You know, because surrealism is, again, I did a lot of reading of surrealism and André Breton yesterday, trying to like get my head around like, well, how do I talk about this? And the problem is Breton and surrealism itself is sort of shifting sands. So, you know, one definition I found of surrealism from one of the artists in the movement was basically, well, you're a surrealist if Breton tells you you're a surrealist. He declared. So it's like, so I really struggled with that sense of like, how does this feel different than The Exterminating Angel? Where this, I feel like there are certain critiques or commentaries that I feel are very obvious in this movie. And that seems the opposite of maybe surrealism a little bit, but maybe not. Like that's the part I struggled with.
Yeah. I think in some ways you could argue this is a more truly surrealist film in that I'm not sure that I think of surrealism as necessarily having an agenda. Exterminating Angel is very much, it's a really pointed critique. And it uses a surrealistic style to make that critique. I think I think the Exterminating Angel is also very much about a particular class. Now, you could say, obviously, this creature armed of the bourgeoisie is about a particular class. But I also think that one of the elements of this film is, okay, I'm going to make a very strange link here, which is not unique to me. It's one of the critics I read. This film, in some ways, is the surrealist version of Rules of the Game. There's an interesting way to think about Buñuel and Renoir, because I think The Exterminating Angel is much more about look at those people and look at what's wrong with that class of society. I think this film is much more about, yeah, look at those people, look at what's ridiculous about the bourgeoisie. But at the same time, you know, they're sort of a little bit like us, or we're a little bit like them, you know? And I think it's, the reason I'm linking to Renoir is I think it's, if this isn't a contradiction, it's a more humanist surrealism than I think you get in Exterminating Angel.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I think ultimately, well, for one reason, because I found them oddly relatable. So it's to my advantage to say, yes, this is a larger critique than just a class critique. But I also think, like, the ideas that and the symbols that sort of jump out don't seem like they are specific to the class, even though this is really, there are some heavy class critiques in this at the same time. For example, the runner throughout this movie of the six of them walking down that country road, like, maybe we just jump into that, like, because that sort of, I think, first shows up kind of in the first third of the movie, and yeah, then it comes back, and it's obviously the end of the movie, yeah. So that feels like a statement. That seems to have a very obvious read to it. You know, the obvious read being, and I'm open to a lot of other reads, and this, the obvious read is maybe not the right one, but the obvious read seems to be these same characters that we're seeing, you know, navigate or try to navigate the sort of the society that they live in, and you know, to use your point, like the rules of that society, the rules of the game, as it were, and all these things, like, is really just masking this kind of wandering, right? Mm-hmm. That life, is life actually this kind of meaningless wander? And honestly, like, a lot of the movie is about these folks trying to fulfill appetites. I mean, they are at their core very appetitive people, whether that those appetites are for food, which is the, you know, the main one that you, when this movie gets pitched to you, but as much so sex, as much so drink, drugs, money, you know, all of these things. And it's like, if we pull back the curtain of all those things, are they all just wandering down this road in kind of a meaningless way? So that's sort of the obvious read of that. And that is definitely not something that is necessarily particular to class. That sort of seems more like human condition.
Yeah, it's like, you know, well, we're lost, but we're making excellent time.
Right, exactly.
And one thing I did not do, Sam, but it would be interesting to do, is I did not go back and watch the three scenes in sequence, because I think I don't know if they look increasingly harried or not, or if they walk increasingly quickly. One of the actresses mentioned that one of the things that got them moving fast was that they figured whoever walked fastest would get the close up. And so so it's also a bit of a commentary. I don't know if this is Buñuel's intention, but it's a bit of a commentary on the actors wanting to be highlighted, the actors wanting attention. And of course, you know, so typical of Buñuel, this is not in the shooting script. This was just something he thought of at some point. And it's almost as though, you know, they're on the way to a destination, but they have no idea what the destination is or where they're going. So you're right. It's easy to see it as a kind of a metaphor, but maybe it's got different elements to it as well. So it's also about performance. It's also about wanting to be noticed. But it's also about, I think, you could also argue it is the reason it's on that country road and they're dressed as though they're for going to a dinner, but there's no civilization in sight. It also maybe points out the kind of the absurdity of the manners that they represent when you compare them to the natural world. It kind of points out the artificiality of the social structure in which they thrive. And maybe it's even raising a question of, well, what would happen if you put these people down in the middle of the country without any of the accoutrements of civilization that kind of prop them up? What if you expose the complete artificiality of not only the bourgeoisie, but of all social structures? I mean, maybe that's pushing it a bit, but he could be asking that question as well. It's almost like they're Robinson Crusoe on the island.
Okay, well, I want to add to that, and this is a thought that just jumped into my head. You said, you know, they're walking and there's no signs of civilization, except that's not true.
No, you're right.
Because
you're
there right. is a sign of civilization, which is the road, right? The road itself. So it's also a, you know, to go back to a movie we watched a long time ago, one of my favorite movies, right? In Apocalypse Now, right? You never get out of the boat. As long as you're on the boat in the river, like, there's still some sense of civilization, right? But it's like once you if you veer off of that, so like they are walking a path where if you step off that path, those things potentially fall apart. So there is that one piece of civilization that throughout all those shots they adhere to. They're not wandering, they're walking a road. But they don't know where they're going.
I'm glad you mentioned Apocalypse Now, because another reading could be this is a post-apocalyptic scene, and the world has ended, and they are the last six left, and they're just walking along. What are they going to do?
Right, right. So you know, again, the pitch to this movie, this is about a dinner party that will never seem to begin. What's interesting is it's also a film about a story or a plot that never seems to begin. This movie is full of things that in a traditional movie would be like, oh, that's what the movie's about, right? So I made a list of all the different plots that seem like this could be movies. So we have love affairs. Mm-hmm. We have drug trafficking, war, terrorist plots, political corruption, religious conversations, revolution, murder. All of these things are in this movie, and they don't mean anything, right? Like they are merely interruptions that are then interrupted. And Buñuel seems to repeatedly steer you away from those plots. He'll introduce them, and then they'll either become dead ends. Like, I love the old woman who's like, I don't like Jesus Christ. And then she says, do you want to hear about it? And he says, later. And it's like, sure. We never see her again. So like, okay, well, that we got introduced to this like seeming interesting moment. And then it's like, well, that's not going to happen. The movie's full of interruptions, right? Something's about to happen, whether it's an affair or a meal, and it gets interrupted in various ways. The big one that he does, which I love, is the noise or the sound of the movie getting overpowered by external noise. Whenever there's an explanation, it's like, oh, the characters are going to say the explanation, but you're just going to hear jet engines or typewriters or sirens. Like, I'm never going to tell you what the actual explanation is. And then the other big interruption is waking from dreams, right? It's like, oh, this thing is happening. This is getting interesting. Oh, wait, this person woke up and that didn't actually happen. So all of this is about how plot and story also refuses to begin.
Which is also the sense in which the entire movie is structured like a dream. Mm-hmm. Because that's what happens, right? You have a dream and something's happening in the dream, and what do you know? You wake up, or the dream suddenly shifts to an entirely different topic. So you could argue that not only does the movie contain dreams within dreams, but the movie itself is structured like a dream.
Well, and because we have the structure of characters waking from dreams and dreams within dreams, when you get to the final wake up where Raphael is waking up, and then there is at that point you're just like, well, did any of this happen, or is this guy had a bad night's sleep and then got up and ate some lamb? Is that what this movie is, or is there a point earlier that happened? And I'd really love that. You don't know by the end, and that I think that's really interesting.
Well, it's also interesting to me that the way the movie begins is stylistically different from any other scene in the film, right? It's and in a sense, the way the film begins tells you you're in a dream world, because you're inside this dark car, and it's very difficult to see where you're going. And I can't believe it's taken me 23 minutes to get to this point, but it's like the opening of Mulholland Drive.
Yep.
And I did want to say something about that, Sam, because you know, anytime you talk about the dreamlike state in films, you know, it's hard not to want to say, well, what about David Lynch? And it's interesting that people don't often make connections between Buñuel and Lynch. And I don't recall Lynch himself talking about Buñuel. And I think maybe that's because, as we've talked about with some of Lynch's films, it is even harder in his films to distinguish reality from the dream. And he's not as interested in social critique, I don't think, as Buñuel is, though I think there's elements of it. But anyway, to me, the opening of this film inside that dark car, it's very different. It's very fluid. It's very dark. And to me, that's kind of the descent into telling us that we are going into a dream world.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking, I was also doing some of these. I was looking at like Lynch connections, things like this. And I was thinking about the things that I read is there's a lot of seems like there's a lot of divides between European surrealism and what ends up being sort of American expressions of surrealism, like Meshes of the Afternoon, which Lynch seems to draw on heavily. Yes. And that those really are related in that they're both surrealist movements, but they seem like they have different DNA to them. So, you know, I think Lynch might be, I was listening to a Boonwell biographer talk about this and somebody brought up Lynch and he's like, it's not really the same thing that they're up to. So I think that seems to be critically kind of how that looks. So in the same way that we have a plot that doesn't want to begin, we likewise have, I think it's interesting to think about the characters, and for a lot of them, we don't get a lot of specifics about them, and those specifics don't seem to matter too much. I mean, I thought it was interesting, like, usually when I watched this twice, the second time I was taking notes, and usually when I take notes, I'm writing characters' names, and I realized, like, it's late in the movie before some characters get named. I mean, like Delphine Seyrig's character, do you have any idea what her name is?
Only because I've looked at the plot list.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, otherwise, like, I don't, does she get called Simone at some point? Maybe.
I'm not sure if she gets called Simone.
You know, so it's like, so some of the characters don't get names. And when you get that initial scene, it's like, I'm not even sure what the relationships are between the characters. You just know that they arrive in this car and you're trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Other than Raphael, it's unclear what any of their jobs are. I mean, clearly the men all are wealthy, but it's unclear what they do. So I found that really interesting. One of my favorite scenes, because I felt uneasy about, like, well, why am I struggling with this? And then the second time we go to that road, you see the characters and they're kind of walking towards the camera. And then he does a series of cuts, and each cut, the characters are rearranged. So it's like, it feels like he's zooming in to kind of, but like cutting for continuity, but there's the opposite of continuity. It's like all of a sudden the character that's on the far right is now in the middle, and this person, so there's also sort of this, like, well, don't worry, there's maybe these people are interchangeable in a kind of way, like, don't yes. don't worry too much about those specifics. So I really like that. Now, the one place where that they do seem, and this gets into some of this critique, is they do seem, you do seem to be able to read them in terms of their class status. That's apparent. You see them relating to, or in relationship to, servants, wait staffs, chauffeurs, things like that. So they definitely define themselves in relation to those. I mean, I think the most clear one is, as you said, like the martini scene, which is also one of the things that I love I can't think of his name, Simone's husband, Francois, when he's making the martinis. He's going into this elaborate description about what a dry martini is and how to make one. And it's just sort of background noise. And that's also a sign that, like, you don't, for a lot of these characters, you don't really need to worry too much about what they have to say, because it's pretty empty. I mean, later on, there's they're talking about the International Women's Movement. And all I know is that it gets brought up, but they don't really say anything about it. Nobody seems to take a stance on anything. But the one thing he takes a stance on is that, like, well, we know how to drink a martini. The lower classes don't know how to drink. So they bring the chauffeur in and he just, you know, throws the whole thing down, and to sort of prove a point that way. So we definitely see their class relationships that way. I also heard that what Francois is doing is actually Boonwell's martini recipe. So he's laying out, hides his martini recipe in the movie, if you want to make a Boonwell dry martini.
which also means that he's kind of twitting himself. Mm-hmm. Right. Because the fact is that Boonwell is a member of the bourgeoisie. I mean, there's a sense in which he has to know that he is implicated in this critique. And so I think putting his martini recipe in there is a great way to do that.
We also can see them, you know, through their symbols of wealth. So their houses, their clothes, their cars, and their access. I mean, the big thing is their access to power, to influence, to these types of things. So, like, you know, when they get put in jail, a phone call is made and they're released. That they have access to the military colonel. They have these are deeply connected people, you know, where that gives them a kind of immunity. I mean, Raphael has literal diplomatic immunity, but they all seem to have a kind of immunity which affects the way that they move through the world.
But you get the sense that on the one hand, they are kind of smug and self-satisfied. But on the other hand, and maybe this comes back to the walking on the road, maybe it comes back to, you earlier alluded to their appetite of nature. They don't seem to be particularly fulfilled people necessarily. So I think that's part of what he's kind of getting at. I mean, obviously they've got their status and they've got their wealth, but and they've got some sense of identity, especially you see that with Raphael and always kind of defending Miranda. But at the same time, they don't seem, to me, they're self-satisfied, but not necessarily fulfilled.
Well, that you just nailed it though. I mean, because again, go back to the main pitch of this movie. It's about this they're appetitive people with the inability to eat.
Yes.
Like and they're appetitive people sexually with where sex is stymied for them. And it's in some ways stymied because of the propriety that they have to live in. So like the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie is also their prison, right? It's like, well, we have to, this person came to the door, so we have to deal with this, and we don't, and this doesn't happen. And or when they go to the restaurant, I love, so after the first dinner is stymied because apparently they came on the wrong night, they all go to this restaurant, and it's the first moment where it's like, this is a strange movie. Because the opening is like, okay, they went on the wrong day, that seems a little weird, but whatever. But they go to this restaurant which is locked. And then they get access and they actually get invited in. And then they start to look at the menu and they're concerned that, well, why is nobody here? That seems strange. And they're concerned that the food is too inexpensive. So, like, well, this can't be good if it's this cheap. And then we discover that the owner of the restaurant is laid out dead in the next room and they're waiting for the coroner, but they very much want to feed them. But again, their sense of propriety keeps. So, like it is, this is really about those things being thwarted. Even Raphael's connection to Miranda, right? Like even that is so defensive, right? Like the I think about the dream, it ends up being a dream scene where he's at the Colonel's party and he's constantly like needing to thwart people saying, well, this is true about Miranda though. And he's like, well, no. Like he has to be constantly defensive, which means he can't take any satisfaction. I think this is about how unfulfilling the bourgeois life is, and maybe how unfulfilling life is, period, is a big piece of this movie. So the other thing that we have then is, these are the kind of the more interesting parts of the movie that I want to get into, are all these kind of subplots, and I put plots in quote because they don't go anywhere, but there are these diversions, and I feel like this is where we go deeper down the surrealist rabbit hole. Like, if you didn't have some of these pieces, the movie would feel like would seem like it was kind of only that critique, but then it's punctuated by these other subplots. So, do you have a favorite of them? Just for because I want to move. There's so much we could get into. Like, do you have a favorite diversion in this movie? And maybe diversion's not the right word, but these are the things that tend to become the interruptions in their lives.
I don't know. I don't know if I have a favorite, but I have to say I do like the sequence that you just alluded to, where Raphael is defending Miranda and ends up shooting the colonel. I love that scene.
Why is that? What draws you to that?
I think the fact that even though it's fairly far into the film, I think it took me a while before I figured out that we were in another dream. And I like the fact that I believe that's one of the dreams within the dreams. And I also liked the fact that it's the first, I liked the shift of tone, because to me that's the scene that really kind of exposes this bourgeois facade, right? Because he and the colonel begin with this very kind of polite conversation. And then as he begins to insult Miranda, it sort of it devolves, right? And then you get then you get the other kind of ultimate facade of murder, which is, demanding satisfaction. So it kind of takes us back to Barry Lyndon, right? And having a duel or pulling out a gun. So it's all very, quote, civilized, but what's being expressed are some very, fundamental human emotions and one of the lowest forms of human aggression, which is murder. So I kind of like the way, in a way, you could argue that scene kind of encapsulates the critique of civilization, if you will, that, that Buñuel is making. And now that I think about this, I want to pair it with another one, so I'm going to have to give you two. And that is, maybe this is my favorite, the bishop absolving his parents' murderer and then murdering him. Maybe I'll say that's even better, but it's also, it's of a piece with this one, right? Because here you have the bishop doing what you're supposed to do, not only as a clergy, but as a Christian, and forgiving this person, et cetera, and then turning around and murdering him. So it both kind of inverts the Miranda scene because he's not taking offense. He's being gracious, but it ends in the same place of killing the opponent.
Can I pair that with a third moment in the film?
Sure.
So when Raphael is has his tryst with Simone interrupted, and then the terrorist comes, right? And I mean, he's very creepy with her, you know, tries to basically somewhere between seduce and assault her. Mm-hmm. And then he lets her go. And so again, he's being gracious, but then once she leaves, he waves the little hanky and has his men basically take her out, kidnap her, kill her. We don't know what happens. So that's a doubling of what we see with the bishop. Like, I am doing this performance of grace, but then I am also asserting this kind of power over you, right? So we see that there as well. Now, what I like about all of those scenes is they speak to this other point we were making earlier, that they also speak to the lack of fulfillment, right? That maybe for the priest, offering grace and forgiveness to the person who killed your parents isn't fulfilling enough, right? So it's like, so then I need to do this other thing, right? Or even the idea of Raphael shooting the colonel is like, yes, that is like the literally the dream of what you would do. That's the dream comeback, right? Is like, you offend me, I demand satisfaction. But how fulfilling is satisfaction? So you killed this colonel. It doesn't change any of the things people were saying. And in fact, it actually, if we look at what the colonel's critique was, it was the number of homicides in Miranda, and he just commits another one. So he basically proves the colonel's point by shooting him.
But you know, linking those three scenes is really interesting, Sam, because it suggests that there is a structure to this film that is not, you know, we often think of structure in terms of plot, but also, you know, we end up talking about theme. But it's almost as though what Buñuel has done is he's taken the elements of a coherent plot and he's kind of thrown it up in the air, and they've all come down in kind of random order. And then what you need to do as the viewer is you need to find ways to connect those, right? So we just link those three scenes. You put those three scenes together and you've got a very coherent thematic critique of a certain element of that world. But because they're strung out and they're interpolated with other elements, you don't necessarily see that through line until you kind of isolate them. So I think we could probably do that with other scenes as well and find different kinds of connections.
Can I please? I have another one.
Oh yeah,
that
do.
Connects to this. Yeah. So my favorite it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when the three women go out for tea.
Oh yes.
And the conversation they're having is very strange. Florence wants to move because she hates the cello and talks about how they've been outlawed from orchestras. And it's interesting because when I was listening to our Exterminating Angel episode, we talked about how the cello is one of the things that's destroyed in order to create firewood. So Buñuel maybe has something with cellos that he wants to a statement he wants to make, or some sort of runner there. But then we get this the lieutenant who comes over and, you know, asks about their childhood and like, what was your childhood happy? And they all say, oh, yes, yes, yes. And then he says, well, mine wasn't. And he tells this story and we get this flashback. So it's not exactly a dream, but it's very, it's as dreamlike as any dream in this movie. And like even the visual tone, it becomes very dark, you know, and cool, you know, in a kind of way. And it's this, so it's him as a young man preparing to get sent off to boarding school by his father. And then he sees the ghosts of his mother. And she tells him also to seek retribution, right? She says, like, this person who says he's your father is not your father. This is your father. And she points to the ghost of his dead father who also died in a duel, right? So we get that duel again there. And she tells him to poison his supposed father, right?
Yeah.
And so there is again this sense of the dead now asking for satisfaction, right? And that lieutenant does not seem particularly fulfilled in the future, right? He seems like a very haunted person. It is a very haunting scene. So like if we're thinking about kind of this, like almost this emptiness to try to level the scales or things like this, like that's another scene that I think speaks into that, to that kind of view. Plus, I mean, that is such a strange scene. The mother first appears as he walks by that window. Then he walks into the room and you hear her voice coming from the closet, but you can't see her. Then when you see her, she's oddly ghostly and her mouth doesn't move as she I mean, everything about that, if he's depicting dreams here, that's the one that feels so perfect. It's like, it's so unsettling. For all the things in that, the thing that's most unsettling is that her mouth doesn't move, but it's so clear she's talking. And I think that also, again, picks up some of those same themes that we were just talking about.
Right. And you have the poison motif, right? Mm-hmm. Which connects with the bishop story. But it, you know, for a minute I thought, oh gosh, this is going to turn out that this, you know, somehow this is actually connected to the bishop. It's not, but the theme of poison certainly connects them as well.
So let's talk about the Bloody Sergeant then. We might as well throw this one in too. And then I want to talk about the other. Well, which dream do you want to do first? Do you want to do the Bloody Sergeant?
Yeah, just do Bloody Sergeant, sure.
Okay, so they're arrested. Another meal is interrupted. They're arrested for drug trafficking. And then we go to the police station and they're telling this kind of ghost story about the Bloody Sergeant who, it seems like, some years earlier, probably in the 60s in Paris, was cracking down on student demonstrations. So I'm assuming this is like echoes of Paris 68 or something that. And we see this bizarre scene of him torturing a student protester in a piano that's electrified. It's definitely the trippiest moment of this. And as he's being tortured, like his cockroaches seem to fall either out of the piano or out of the student, which makes me think of Un Chien Angelou, where the ants are coming out of the hand, and it's like,
oh yeah,
I don't know what to make of that. Boonwell said those were his favorite characters in the movie were the cockroaches. So we're told that he comes back every year on this date to redeem himself, is what they say, and they're all afraid. And what's interesting is that when we actually see him come back in this dream, he comes back and frees our six, I don't know if protagonist is the right word, our six main characters. You know, there's this sense that he's going to come and like render justice on them. And actually he comes and lets them out. And that's all that happens, right? And that's the nightmare for the police detective is, oh, the Bloody Sergeant came, and we realize the character of the Bloody Sergeant is just another officer who's very much alive.
Right.
so that's an interesting inversion of what the nightmare is, right? The nightmare for him is the fact that these folks would just have the ability to walk out, and then we get the hammer of the next thing that happens is the phone rings and the Home Secretary is like, release them right now. So it's like, well, the Bloody Sergeant came in a different way.
That's right. Yeah. And even when he's waking, it's as though he's still in a world of dream logic, because he really never can understand or hear exactly why he's releasing them, right? Because the external noise comes and we don't know either as the audience, which is also kind of a commentary on how power often works in society, right? We don't know how people get to exercise certain power, but they're able to do it. I didn't do a lot of research on this, Sam. I didn't find an immediate significance to June 24th, which is the Bloody Sergeant Day. I don't know if you
no, I didn't find anything.
I was hoping it was Bunwell's birthday, but it's not. So I don't know why he picked June 24th.
And then we get the final interruption dream. So not the main character's dreams, but we get when the colonel is first introduced. So they're sitting down for a party, and then this is also one of the stranger things that happens is the army just shows up, and it's like, oh yeah, we were supposed to come yesterday to stay here. And they're doing military maneuvers, but then later on when the maneuvers begin, it sure sounds like they're just actually firing ordnance at each other. Like it's unclear whether this is a military exercise or whether it's war. But they seem shielded from the war to a certain degree. And so as the soldiers are sitting and eating, this other, I think he's a sergeant, comes in to deliver this message that they have to go to war. But before they go to war, he whispers into the colonel's ear, and then the colonel says, well, he has a dream he wants to tell you about. And then we get, again, this is the other, I think, great, strange, really well done depiction of a dream, where it's this sergeant who's walking down a street that is so clearly and intentionally artificial. Like, it is, you see the painted backdrop behind him, and you see the line on the floor where it's like, clearly this is not, you're not meant to think this is real. You're meant to think there's this artificiality to it. And he meets a friend and they start to talk, and you realize it's like they're talking around him being dead, or maybe both of them being dead. He talks about, like, I haven't seen you for 6 years, and you smell of earth, and you're like, okay, what is this? And then that friend goes into a room, and then another person comes up, and that's where you get the realization of, like, well, that person died. And then he meets this woman who, I don't know if you had this, I struggled to figure out, when they talked, it seemed like she was a girlfriend or a lover or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then later he talks about missing his mother and calling out for his mother, and I was unclear, like, was that his mother? And she seems mm-hmm. younger than he is, and again, that's where I think the surrealism is just really thick, because, like, I'm he functions to make me feel very unsettled and doesn't give me the comfort of explanation, but mm-hmm. he wants you to think about it. Mm-hmm. So and that's one where I don't know what to make of that story. Some of the others, like, we've discovered, I think, in this conversation, like, oh, interesting, this is echoing this other thing. What are your thoughts on that story?
Well, certainly it's one of Buñuel's own dreams, right? That's the one that he had. So in a sense, it's kind of a very personal moment for Buñuel. And I guess you could argue, Sam, that even though we've been talking about how some the dreams and some of these sequences link up with each other thematically, I don't think that Buñuel feels compelled to limit himself to that kind of logic. So I think it's also, so he gives the sergeant that dream because it's his own dream. But I think that including it as part of a larger picture is back to this idea that the bourgeoisie are different from us, but they're not so different from us. So in the same way that we see the bourgeoisie having their dreams, it's almost as though it's a democratic process. Like, we're going to give the lieutenant his dream, the earlier one. We're going to give the policeman his dream. We're going to give the sergeant his dream. So the idea is that we all have these dreams. But I also would point out that those dreams, especially this particular dream, has a much more kind of personal element to it. Mm-hmm. It's not about being afraid of being found out, which is what all the bourgeois dreams are about. It's about your past, and it's about painful memories, and it's about a desire to return to or recoup or kind of redeem something from the past. So I think Buñuel he's kind of ringing changes on the various ways that dreams can function. So dreams aren't just about expressing anxieties, or they're not just about making social critiques, but they're also just about affirming some basic elements of our nature, connecting us with our past, expressing our sorrows. And I think he's given himself a structure that allows him to do that without saying necessarily, well, how does the sergeant's dream kind of fit into a bigger scheme?
Right. No, and I think anybody listening to this, like, we're finding connections, but I don't know that those are definitely not the connections. And I do think it is more to the surrealist project of, I mean, almost the Dada nature of the surrealist project of, like, let's just put stuff there and connections will organically come, because that's the idea of the artwork, right? Is that you place these things next to each other, and you may or may not see connections, or you may see different connections, right? Like, I don't think that there's a huge degree of intent that this is not a puzzle box he's trying to get us to solve.
Right, right.
Now, what I find interesting about both the sergeant's dream and the lieutenant's story, and this might be something he's going for, is people don't really know how to deal with somebody revealing that much. So when the lieutenant tells his story, I mean, it is a haunting, disturbing story. And their response is like almost relief that the waiter comes and says, sorry, we're out of coffee. So then they can pivot to that and be like, I don't really want to deal with that. In the same way, when the sergeant tells his story about, you know, encountering these dead friends, the initial response is one of the other soldiers is like, now tell us the train dream. It's like, these are amusements. Let's not dwell on this stuff. Even though he just showed us like a really disturbing thing that we probably should sit and think about. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's like, how do we get on from this? How do we move on from this?
Yeah.
So the other, I think, famous dream sequence in this is the theater scene.
Yes, yes.
We haven't mentioned. So this is the dream within a dream. So this is the first attempt to envision the colonel's party, and they walk in and they start to notice, oh, you know, this is strange. The food is, or excuse me, the liquor is all cola, and this is the first time they play with Napoleon's hat. I love this little, it appears twice in there, and it shows the irreverence of these folks.
Yes,
you know, where it's like I think he takes the case off and like puts on this hat that Napoleon wore, and then later you see Florence, this is in the second time around, Florence is wearing it, and I think Raphael says that it looks effeminate on her, which is strange because she's a woman, but he's also saying, is he saying Napoleon looks effeminate? Right. I'm not sure about that. And then I think it's Simone who says, oh, I've already seen three hats that Napoleon wore at this battle. So it's just like, there's sort of this rejection of, mm-hmm. and maybe this is actually a positive thing, rejection of too much reverence for history and a sense of heroizing history or things like this. But it's such a strange little thing that they do in this party.
Well, actually, I'm glad you put that. I read it a little bit differently. I read it like, okay, you think you've got a special object,
right?
Right. Your object isn't so special. It's like, you know, there's two or three others of these. So I think it's a diversion away from jealousy. Like, oh, you've got Napoleon's hat. It's like, who knows? Nobody's really got Napoleon's hat.
Right. Exactly. So then they sit down to the dinner, and the waiter brings out these chickens, which already look a little strange because it's just two chickens sitting on a tray. Yes, there's nothing else. And then he bumps his arm and they fall to the ground, and he puts them back on and serves them. And then they realize that they're plastic. And then we get this great moment where the opposite wall, literally the fourth wall we haven't seen, with the camera moves to the opposite of the 180 degree line. So we see it's a red curtain, which opens, and you see a crowd of people in a theater watching them, and everybody else gets up and leaves. And there's this stage manager who's like trying to feed them lines. And I think the bishop gives a half-hearted effort and then leaves. And eventually then you just have Henri there sweating, you know, having, and this is the most, stereotypical dream of like, I'm in a play and I don't know my lines. But it's also sort of this sense of like, they are people who, I mean, a part of the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie is they know, at least theoretically, you know, like how to deflect, how to say the right thing. Like, this is what makes them charming and inconspicuous in a kind of way, is that they know how to do this. And this is the nightmare of, what if I didn't know what to say? What if I'm being observed and I don't know what to say? And you just see him sweating, and then he wakes from that dream. And then we go to the what we think is the real colonel's party. We have the duel, and then we have Francois waking from that dream and saying, basically, he's the one who tells us he has had a dream within a dream. He's had a dream of Henri's dream, and then a dream of the party, and that's where we realize we're so far down the rabbit hole that I sort of threw my hands up and thought, I'm not going to worry about what's real and what's not real, because he's tipped his hand to say any of this. At any point, somebody could wake up, and basically, to the viewer, at some point, you're going to wake up, and this is going to be over too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, when the curtain parts, it's kind of like the reminder that you're watching a movie, you know, you're actually in a play. It's not the reality you think that it is. But I also want to say one more thing about dreams and the function of the dreams, Sam, because, you know, Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream was popping into my head. And I when I was there with students at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford 20 years ago or so, we talked to one of the actors who played Puck, and we were talking about, you know, are other people's dreams interesting or not, right? And, you know, we've all had that experience of wanting to tell somebody our dream and feeling like, well, nothing could be more boring to me than what you're dreaming about. Just the other day, I tried to tell my wife about a dream, and she didn't think it was particularly interesting. But when I think about what happens in Midsummer Night's Dream, the play, you know, when I've taught that film, you know, that play, you know, one of the things I always end up talking about is that there's a certain kind of catharsis that goes on as a result of those dreams. People, as a result of the action of the play, that people take on different roles. You get kind of an inversion of the social order. It's a classic kind of carnival experience where the world gets turned upside down in order to get it turned right side up again. And it seems to me that in some ways, Bunuel is doing that with some of the bourgeois dreams, right? They have these terrible fears, and they're realized in the dream, and then they wake up and they realize, oh, it's actually okay. But the difference is that it doesn't really transform their relationships. It doesn't change how they think about the world or the relationship to the world. It's not like, oh, maybe I should realize this about myself or my situation. It's more like, oh gosh, I'm glad. You know, I'm glad that I escaped that, so everything's going to be okay after all. I mean, it's the classic cliche, it was only a dream. And I think that's also how their dreams maybe contrast with the dreams that the sergeant and the lieutenant and the policeman have, because those dreams in some ways really do connect to reality for them. For the bourgeois, it's like, no, I dreamt that, it's over with, let's get on with life, let's walk down the road.
Well, and you, okay, that was a perfect setup to the end of this movie. So we have the final dinner scene where I assume it's the Mirandan terrorists who come in and machine gun up the place. It's unclear, because these are not characters we've seen before, but everybody gets killed except for Raphael, who's hiding under the table. And then he exposes himself when he reaches up to grab a piece of lamb. And so then he's discovered under the table and he's shot, and then he wakes up. And to your point, if this whole movie were a dream, he doesn't learn a thing, right? He gets up, and what is the first thing he does is he eats.
Yes,
right? He's like,
yes.
You know, it's right back to appetite, right? It's right back to feeding that. And then we get the shot of them walking down the road. So I think that's definitely, it's part of their, you know, and I'm going to use this word in a different way now. It's part of their immunity, right? That mm-hmm. they have this immunity to, learning from experience, you know, maybe, right? Like, and if whether the dreams are real, or whether the movie's real or dreams, they are experiences, and are they capable of actually learning something from that? And Bunuel is maybe saying, maybe not. Maybe that's something they're not. Anything else you want to say about this film as we're wrapping up?
Yeah, I just want to go to my favorite critic, A.O. Scott. A.O. Scott reviewed the film on its re-release in 2000. And, you know, sometimes in our conversation, Sam, we locate films, you know, in terms of the moment when they were released. And so you talked a little about 1972. Well, it's interesting that when A.O. Scott looked at it in 2000, he wanted to locate it in terms of other films or filmmakers that he would draw connections to. So one of them is Pedro Almodovar, whom we've not yet watched, what we will. But then he says that Bunuel's Dada spirit surfaces in Being John Malkovich.
Oh, sure.
The connection I wouldn't have thought of. He also made a connection to Run Lola Run in terms of what he's called overlapping realities. And then he even says the spooky dimension to the movie, an evocation of childhood's deepest nightmares and richest sorrows, may remind you of The Sixth Sense. So those are interesting connections that I never would have made. So, you know, if listeners are wondering not only about other Bunuel films, and by the way, I think that after this film, you probably move to That Obscure Object of Desire if you want the next Bunuel masterpiece. But it also could suggest other filmmakers that may be of interest.
Yeah, and this seems I like what Scott's saying there, because this is influential in a way where you don't have to make a Bunuel film, but there can be, in the same way a dream, a little piece of a dream can teach you something, a little piece of this movie can say, what if we took that idea and blew that out into something, you know, bigger or more interesting, or may had a scene that had a touch of that sense. Yeah, no, I definitely thought a lot of Charlie Kaufman. I mean, so Being John Malkovich is a Charlie Kaufman script, and I thought about Charlie Kaufman movies when I was watching this as well. Like, he seems like he's definitely learned things from Buñuel.
Can I also point out that in that Obscure Object of Desire, he has two different actresses play the same role without any explanation. And if that sounds like Lost Highway,
yes,
that sounds like Lost Highway.
All right. So what do you have for us for, we're going to take a break for spring break next week. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. What do you have for us, Barrett?
A little bit of a change of pace. Sam, we've done a few kind of classic British films, especially one of your favorite, one of my favorite films from the '40s, The Third Man, Carol Reed. So I want to go back and, you know, British film doesn't necessarily have a huge reputation, but there's some really good films and filmmakers. And the team I'm particularly interested in is Emmerich Pressburger and Michael Powell, who make the so-called Archer films. So some of these have become available on the Criterion Channel. One I've been wanting to do with you for quite a while, A Matter of Life and Death. From 1946, which is, if people want to think about a pairing with this film, you could go back and listen to a rewatch Defending Your Life. That's one I would have paired if it had been available at the time.
I was wondering when we were going to get to Pressburger and Powell. Those were names that were sitting out there. And I've been talking with you about weird synchronicities in life. On my walk in today, I was listening to a podcast where somebody was talking about A Matter of Life and Death. So this has already been part of my life today. So I'm very excited. I've never seen any of their films. I'm very excited for this. So Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film. This was really great. And I think this was definitely enhanced by talking about it, by unpacking it. I feel like I have even more respect for this movie as I think about as we've dug into it. So thank you for recommending this. Thank you for having this conversation. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back in 2 weeks to talk about A Matter of Life and Death in the Video Store.